Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All Things Therapy with Lisa Tahir, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello there, and welcome to All Things Therapy. I'm your host, Lisa Tahir. I'm a licensed clinical social worker practicing as an intuitive psychotherapist as well as a Reiki practitioner. You can find me online through my website, which is nolatherapy.com. It's the abbreviation for New Orleans, Los Angeles Therapy. And from my site, you're able to schedule sessions to meet with me remotely through phone, Skype, or FaceTime, or you're welcome to meet in person at my New Orleans or Los Angeles office locations. I also come to you and do on-site, on-location therapy sessions. Secondly, you are able to listen to archived episodes of this show and subscribe to this show through the links that are on NOLA Therapy to iTunes and Google Play. And lastly, if you like and enjoy what you have been hearing, I would love for you to support my work through my crowdfunding campaign with Patreon. There is a link at NOLA Therapy. Additionally, you can check out Patreon because there's so many artists, writers, podcasters that you can support for as little as a dollar a month through Patreon, Patreon.com. And the link to my page is just / Lisa Tahir, all one word. I'm going to shift into introducing my guest. In just moments, I will be with Linda Joy Myers, PhD. She is president and founder of the National Association of Memoir Writers. She herself has authored 4 books individually, and she has co-authored 2 books. Linda Joy additionally offers private coaching for writers and teachers. She teaches ongoing classes, is what I meant to say, regarding memoir writing. In 6 months, her and her writing partner, Brooke Warner, teach that together. And she writes for the Huffington Post. She's also been a therapist for over 35 years in the Bay Area and believes in writing as a powerful healing modality. Today, we'll be talking about her book, Song of the Plains, a memoir of family secrets and silence. And this book is really a deep dive into spirituality and finding our identity and purpose. Linda Joy, thank you for being with us today and welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Lisa. I'm really thrilled to be talking with you today.
You're welcome. I am too. And I wonder where you would like to start our discussion today.
Well, it depends on what you would like, but we could talk about the book. We could talk about the themes. You know, there's a lot of themes having to do with healing in the book, as well as generational patterns that I was exploring about healing. So just launch in and we'll have a great time.
Sure. Well, you know, I like when you talk in your work about how we are all walking storybooks. And so I wondered maybe that's a place to start. You also speak about people being witness storytellers. So can you just say some more about that for us?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, I like to tell people this story about, you know, people say, well, how did you get into this whole thing of memoir writing and, you know, how did all this happen? And so I talk about my great-grandmother, Blanche, who I met for the first time when I was 8 years old. And she and I were lying in a feather bed in the summers at night in Iowa where she lived. I lived in Oklahoma with my grandmother, because my parents had already split up and left. So as we lay in this feather bed, Blanche started telling me stories. And she told me the story about being a young girl in Iowa in the 1870s is when she was born.
Wow.
Actually, Later, I found out she was born, I mean, I did the math later on when I learned history. She was born 3 years before Custer's last stand.
Oh, my gosh.
Seems like a really long time ago, right?
It does.
And it is. You know, it's a different world, such a different world. And living almost like pioneers, they were on a farm. And she, you know, they had the neighbor farmer women would be midwives for each other. The women worked all day and all night. There was no electricity. There, you know, they had wood cook stoves to cook on summer and winter. So she told me all these things in such specifics that I was like there with her. And then she told me something else. She told me about the marrying my grandmother's father on January 1st, 1894. And that they were married for 2 months and then he died.
Yes.
And I was 8 years old and I was like, oh my goodness. I was trying to wrap my mind around all this. And I sat there, I was sitting in front of her looking down at her. And all of a sudden, after about 30 to 40 minutes of all these stories, I realized she was a walking storybook.
Yes.
And I realized everyone around me were everyone was a walking storybook. All these adults had these things zipped up inside of them, you know? And I wanted to know everything. I wanted to know more about her. I certainly, I guess, good training to be a therapist, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I wanted to know why my mother left, why I learned from her that my grandmother had abandoned my mother when she was a little girl, and my mother had already left me behind. And I was like, what was this all about? I mean, it was really slightly unusual to be doing that. So that's how it began. I mean, so I became curious, and I just did everything I could to find out everything, much to the irritation later on in life, to these same relatives who, not her, but other other relatives are like, why are you asking us all these questions? But,
well,
you know.
And Linda Joy, I'm thinking for our listeners that haven't read your book, yet I share that I just completed it moments before we called you to start our interview, that you were abandoned by your mother. Mm-hmm. She left you with your grandmother, I think at age four, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yes.
And and you were sent to live initially with kind of like a foster family that was, they were horribly abusive and cruel. And you started to shut down as a young girl and just lose your voice and your sense of yourself. And thank God your grandmother, when you visited her, noticed that something was wrong with you and took custody of you, basically. Correct?
Yes, these people had dropped me off at her house because I was sick. They were sort of what we call tag-in relatives. I was sick, and I wouldn't talk. I just sat around, and I was like I am now. Before this happened, I was a blabbermouth. You know, I'd be chatting away, and so she thought something was terribly wrong, and she literally begged me to tell her what happened there.
Yeah.
And she knew stuff happened. So I finally broke down and told her, and most of it, not all of it, but she refused to let them take me. And she yelled at my mother and father and said, I'm keeping her. So, yeah.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
And you also talk in your work, when you were interviewed and asked, when did you start this book, that you realized you started writing this book at age eight. When you met your great grandmother and laid in her feather bed and were told the stories of your mother and her mother and this history of abandonment of women abandoning their daughters. And just as therapists, that relationship with our mother is primary as women in our identity and development. So can you weave some of those themes into for us today?
The interesting thing about my mother and grandmother, I mean, I saw my mother every year. She came to visit on the train, and then she and her mother would have these knockdown, drag out, not quite literally, but almost fights. And my mother would run off suddenly in the night in a cab, and I would be panicking. But I was with my mother long enough. I was alone with my mother until I was four, so I only knew her until then. And I loved her, and I felt very connected to her. So it was quite excruciating to watch them with these fights and all this. But the part about identity is that my grandmother and my mother shared a lot of physical characteristics. They looked very similar to each other.
Okay.
And I look like them, too. And so there's this whole thing about you look in the mirror and say, when you're a child, and say, well, gosh, am I going to be like them? You know?
Right.
Am I doomed? You know, basically. And I was, you know, I think children, and I hear this from many different people who have been adopted or had various interruptions in their family history, and I think you get very serious when you're young. You start asking questions, maybe not out loud, because maybe the adults don't want to answer them, but
right.
You start wondering about things, and you become contemplative and, you know, maybe introspective and have a lot of questions. And so I was just one of those children that always wanted to understand more. So I would, and this happens to a lot of other children I've talked to, you start looking for clues. Okay, what is the body language showing you that particular day? Is somebody angry? Are they happy? Are they about to pounce on you and criticize you? What is going on? And you learn to become watchers, and you learn to become tuned in to every little thing. Now, that might be a survival skill, but if you're like that when you're older, you get a little weird, you know? I mean,
right. Well, you learn to read the environment very young.
Yeah, right. So it's good for a writer, though, and it's good for a therapist in a way. I mean, I'm always talking to people about how can you use what you learned when you grew up to help you now do things you may not even have thought you could do. And when I first started writing, I didn't think I could write. In fact, I couldn't write very well. I mean, not as well. I read constantly, so I know what a good book is.
Yes.
I know what a good story is. And when you first start writing, it's very depressing. But
it's challenging. I've started to write my first book, and it's like exercising a new muscle that I've never used.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's like, wow, really intense.
It is. And the fun thing is you learn how to do it better and you get better at it. But by becoming observant, I mean, in terms of looking at how people heal, how people come to terms with their own story, if you become observant and pay attention to details, it can be very useful if you're a writer or if you're a therapist and somebody's sitting across from you and you notice this little twitch that they have or this subtle feeling that comes across them, then it allows you to tune into that and maybe in a different way than you would otherwise. So it's all right in the end.
Yes. And you're also, I wanted you to share, you have a PhD, you've been a therapist for almost 40 years, you have an MFA in creative writing, you are an artist, a musician. Can you share with us how all this evolved for you?
Yeah. Well, I was very lucky. My grandmother, which we might talk about more later about her, but she raised me early on, particularly, she was a very positive figure. And then later, she had her own problems that really got in the way of our relationship when I was in high school. But before then, she loved the arts. She loved reading. She had books everywhere. And she had me read Treasure Island when I was 8, which I could barely do.
Yeah.
Read when you're 8. Look up all the words in dictionary. I didn't always like that, but I think there was value in it. And then she wanted me to, you know, she thought it'd be great if I played the piano when she got a piano. And, of course, as I look back, I realized she wished that she could play the piano.
Mm.
And so she was trying to have me be somebody through music. And then later I played the cello, and it was very good that I had these outlets and these expressions. It turns out I didn't find this out till later when I was working on this book, but she had been to Europe. I thought she'd been to England once. Later I found out more about it, but we can talk about that later. And so she had been left that small world of Iowa, and she'd lived in Chicago, and she had, you know, sampled and tasted literally the larger world. And most people in the little town I grew up in, Enid, Oklahoma, hadn't done that. So, you know, she brought a lot of culture to me. The problem was she kind of force-fed me a bit. You know, so...
Say that last part again, Linda Joy. She kind of what a bit?
Force-fed me a little bit.
Okay, in what ways?
Well, just being very determined that I would be the best pianist in town and the very best cellist in town and better than all those other kids. And then I would... Her story was, you'll get it with this story. Her story was that one day I would play at Carnegie Hall, I would get the flowers, and then I would give them to her.
Wow. Okay. So you still not a lot of room for you in that.
You're noticing that.
Yeah.
So I turned away from music eventually. I became a music major. But then, you know, when I was in my 20s, I was like, what else am I missing out on in life? I have been practicing and practicing and practicing. I did not want to be a professional musician. I had terrible stage fright. It was excruciating. And I didn't want a career in music. I was curious about art and dance and other things. So, you know, I didn't touch a musical instrument for 15 years while I was also in therapy working on kind of, you know, music abuse or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And I got so that I couldn't even listen to music for many, many years. But I was determined to be on a healing path and, you know, get over the things that blocked me and find the things that I could do that I love.
And I like how you talk about that, your healing, your wounds, and your healing of them in Song of the Plains, in this memoir. Can you talk to us about your memoir specifically? Yeah. So listeners get a sense of what it's about so that they are inclined to go buy it and read it.
To go buy it.
Yeah.
Well, Song of the Plains is a love song to the plains, literally. Mm. I grew up in Oklahoma under gigantic big skies, where the weather and the wind and the rain and the storms were not only metaphorical, which they were, but they were very real, powerful forces. And I learned young, and also I lived in the area where there were huge swaths of golden wheat fields every spring. And so there was a moment when I was 18 years old, it was June before they had cut the wheat. And in those days, the wheat would come up to my chest. It was very
cold.
They've changed it now, I found out, unhappily.
Okay.
I went to a wheat field a few years ago, and I'm like, what happened here? But anyway, back then it was very tall, so that you're in the middle of this sweeping, swirling gold. And the moon was rising in the east, and it happened to be, like, gigantic. It was huge. And I stood there, and there was this moment where I suddenly knew that no matter what happened, I would be okay because I was part of this larger beauty.
Wow.
And that this larger beauty was always here for me. And I'd already been to the wheat field quite a few times to soothe myself, or sometimes when my grandmother would be angry, I would just go outside and stand outside and let the wind push me around.
Yeah.
So the landscape became friendlier than many people to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't a hiker or anything. It's not like I was a sports enthusiast, but it was a spiritual, I believe it really was a spiritual connection with something bigger than myself.
Yes.
And that is how it came through. And so for all these years, many years, over 50 years now, when I've been upset in my own life for whatever reason and doing the healing work, sometimes I would close my eyes and I would go to that wheat field again. And so I wanted to write a book that was about my story and about people and about generational patterns And I also wanted to share that there are ways to find yourself in the darkness that are magical and small and yet huge ways of disconnecting from the pain and connecting into something more positive.
Yes.
So that is part of why I wrote that book. There's more, but I'll let you see if there's anything else you want to ask about that.
Well, and the research, so your book is, it's your story, it's your mother's story, Josephine or Jotine, as she was referred to, your grandmother who had more names, Lulu, Lula, Frances. And
gosh, you did your homework, ma'am. That's great.
Yes.
You got all the names down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love reading and researching, so thank you. And then your great-grandmother, Blanche, from the farm, with just you, and through Song of the Plains, you just talk about the farm and just the hard work. That living was so hard. It sounds like especially for women, cooking and just chores were never done. And so, and I'm trying to think of where to go next.
I have a suggestion. You know, I want to talk about the middle part of the book because you're connecting with it right now. And
that
in the middle of the book, I write about my young life and how I came all the way through those years with my mother, with my grandmother, and then my mother's continued rejection and my father and some of the things he did, and wove in, and I teach this, I wove in the positive stories about everybody in that first 150 pages, not just the dark stories. And I teach people to do that. You know, what are the things that saved you? Please put that in your book, you know.
Yes.
And then I thought, you know, but this story is so much bigger than me and even the three of us. It is bigger than that. And what happened is that I had written a piece in the 90s, the early 90s, that was almost like a channeling. And it had a different voice. And it was about the pioneers. It was about America. Mm-hmm. It was about how the sweep of people across the United States and how my family was a part of that. So it's entirely, it's not, it is the story that came to me in sort of a poetic form.
Okay.
Of that era, and I just allowed it to write itself. And when I got to the middle of my book, I went, you know, I didn't even know if this story had a place to live, but I think it belongs here. And I would like to read the first paragraph to you.
Please.
May I read that? Just a, it's
yes.
Very short. So here was the voice, and you can see it's different than my regular voice. They came from across the big waters, the ships carrying them to the shores. Joseph begat 11 children, and Jesse was one of his sons. And they begat children, and the generation sifted through the land, pushing the natives from the land of their ancestors, land shared with all, air and water and land shared freely with the living creatures who needed those gifts. So I wanted to bring in the idea that our wonderful Western progress also created a, obviously, a wound in our land, you know, with the native people being pulled away. And I always felt that as a child. And I wanted to say to people, hey, look at this. Yeah, we're here, you know, and we got there and we got to sit on that land. But that land had a history long before we arrived, and that we need to honor that.
Yes. That's beautiful. And your work, it's over 30 years of research, correct, that has gone into this book. And regarding your family history.
Right. So, you know, when you grow up with, and I'm not the only one who's grown up with fragmented family, with lots of questions, you know. So I wanted to address the idea that you may actually be able to work on your healing by getting more information or finding out the stories of the people that shaped you. So I had already spent a lot of time trying to find out when did my grandmother leave my mother? How old was she developmentally? I'm a therapist, you know, like, okay, developmentally, you know, how did this affect my mother's psychology, my mother's psyche? Because she was clearly not well, you know.
Right.
And so some of the research started by finding her birth certificate, finding out the history of the family. But then what happened, and this is for other people, anyone can do this, and this is some research that I'm doing a little writing about in blogs and stuff, is that I found out that the local tiny newspaper in this very small town in Iowa, Wapello, Iowa, would list visitors and social events, and I found our family over 7-year period listed in this newspaper. And so I there's my mother, and she's like a baby, and there's my grandmother, who when she was 22 years old, taking her baby to go visit the relatives.
Wow.
And it was like I discovered their humanity and their youth and their vulnerable. They were they were young and vulnerable, just like I and my daughter and sons were. It gave me this love and this tenderness toward them that I kept exploring.
Yes. And I think, Linda Joy, that what you're saying is so important for anyone listening on their own healing path. All of us have been wounded by others in some way, shape, or form. It's just part of being alive. And I think to look at our parents or whomever it was that hurt us, and to really look to see the child that they were, to really see them as a younger person, can really promote feeling empathy for them, mm-hmm. and allow for the process of forgiveness to happen for us. To just see them from a different perspective and vantage point. So it sounds like that really began to unfold for you during your research to the two different places before there was Ancestry.com and all the online resources
that
you had to go.
Yeah. You had to go to courthouse and lift down gigantic leather tomes that were dusty with spider webs on them. And look up things then. And I'm really glad I did that, because there's nothing like holding a huge book of hundreds of names of people who once lived right there, who are long gone, but there their names are, names and names and names and names and births and deaths and everything. It was really quite profound. You get a truly visceral experience with history.
Yes. Well, and you talk in your work about your book being an archaeological dig into our lives. And this was an archaeological dig into your life and your mother's and your grandmother's and your great-grandmother.
Yes, and then I want to talk a little bit about what I discovered more recently, because what happened is that I searched and searched and searched and found much of what I wanted to find, but it was still a bunch of guesswork because, for instance, you can't hardly find divorce records live. I couldn't find them. I mean, I don't know what box they kept them in the courthouse, but we never did find that particular box. We couldn't find various things and who lived where, when, and all this. And so about 5 years ago, I bought into Ancestry.com and started creating a family tree. And I knew I had some relatives that had done genealogical work before. And so I had a lot of information. And the more information you plug into there, the more information the algorithms do in Ancestry.com. Oh. They go in there and work for you.
Okay.
Great experience. And then little leaves pop up and they give you all this data. And so what happened was a short time ago. It was only a couple years ago. I write in my book earlier that I knew that my grandmother had gone to England once, because she would tell me the story about England and how much she loved it, and she read English literature all the time, et cetera, et cetera. But up popped this little green leaf, and it said something about international data from ships manifest.
Okay.
You know, so I went there, paid my money. My gosh, this lady had gone to England 4 times and had gone to Cuba once.
Oh, wow.
I almost fell off my... Well, I did fall
Cuba,
off.
Cuba, yeah.
I had my kitty sitting next to me, and I started squealing, and they all jumped up and ran off, you know. Quite funny.
Yes.
And so it was this huge, amazing discovery of a part of her life I didn't know. So what happened is I ended up tracking her various trips, and I found, I looked up, I found the ships online. I found pictures of the ship online. I read the ship's manifest. And so she spent a month at a time, or 2 months possibly one time, in England in the 30s before World War II, and Scotland.
Okay.
And I went, oh, this is why she loved England so much. She spent a lot of time there.
Yeah.
This is why she loved English literature. This is why, a part of why she was the way she was. And the way, the thing that changed when I found this, I was so happy to find a period of her life when I think she was happy.
Yeah.
I think those were the highlights of her life. And then when I look back at the story she told me through that new lens, because we can always look through a new lens, mm-hmm. at what we know, I went, oh my gosh, this is what she was trying to give me. And by the way, I've been to England 5 times now, too.
Okay.
But, you know, she gave a gift of culture, and she gave a gift of travel, and she gave a gift of fearlessness in a way. I mean, not too many women traveled alone in the 1930s on ships.
You're right about that. I hadn't thought of that.
No. Yeah. Isn't that amazing? And I went, wow. I mean, I travel alone now, and people will say, what? You travel alone? I'm like, well, yeah. What's the problem with that? And they're like, oh. I thought, wow, what was that like in the 30s?
Certainly.
And you know, it wasn't.
No, you first, Linda Joy, and then I'll ask.
Well, you know, what you find out through genealogical research, and then you're in history, and then what I did and what I think it's great for people to do is research the history. What was it like in the 1930s in the United States and in Europe and in England? How were people living? What did they think? You know, we tend to look back at history through our own eyes who've studied history in a book. But when you're really immersing yourself in a place and time that they lived in, you have to stand in their shoes. And so that's what I did in a lot of the last part of the book, is that I wrote some of it through her point of view as if I were in her shoes. And that was fun.
Yeah. You know, going with this theme that you brought up about holding up a different lens. We can choose to look through a different lens at any time. I think what we do as therapists and other healing practitioners is like when you go to the eye doctor and you sit in the chair and they start holding up all those lenses so you can look and see when does the image get more clear, how we can refocus and shift how we view things to see an image that we thought one way about in different aspects. So there are two moments in your book, Song of the Plains, that were really powerful, kind of emotionally charged points for me that I wanted to ask you about and share with our listeners.
You.
Yeah. One of them being is you have a daughter and a son, and you were telling a story about how you would bring your children when they were young to visit your mother. And this powerful moment of where your little son, I forgot exactly how young he was, but it was, I think, between 5 and 7, said something like, Mom, why do you bring us here? She doesn't even want us. Talking right. about your mother, his grandmother. And just, I can't imagine what that was like the aha moment for you, for your little son to notice that you all were unwanted by your mother. And if you could just talk for a bit about that.
Yeah. Right. It all started when I was 20 years old, and I visited my mother in Chicago. And I write this out fully in my first book, Don't Call Me Mother, because it's named after this moment. And she wouldn't introduce me to a friend of hers that we were visiting. And I couldn't figure out why she wouldn't introduce me. I had never been to Chicago before, and I was my first visit to her. And she turned to me after we left, and she just said, you have to understand, no one knows that I was ever married. She went by the name of Miss Myers, which was her maiden, her married name, but she added Miss. And she says, no one knows I have a was ever married, and they don't know that I have a daughter, and I don't want you to interfere with that. And I stumbled along behind her, and I felt like I'd been stabbed in the heart. And she said things like that several other times.
Yeah.
Only one. But I'm one of these people, I was like, well, I'm not going to let her get away with that. She's not going to get rid of me. You know, I was like going to fight it, and I was going to prove to her that I was worthy to be her daughter.
Yes.
That really I was a good person. It's not that she did it for that reason, but still, you know, that's where it went psychologically for me. There must be something wrong with me, or why would she do this? And so then I had children, and then family was important. So I thought, well, maybe she'll appreciate them, or they should at least know her, at least meet her, even though she was difficult. And so I had done that two or three times, and she would try to hide them, too.
Yes, I remember reading that.
Down hallways where no one would see us, and in the back of the hotel, and in the, you know, she told us not to call her mother or grandmother. So then my son, this is like the third time that he'd seen this, and he just nailed the truth right there, and she was not sitting there right then. She'd gone to make a phone call or something, and it was like from the mouths of babes, I heard him say that, and I am like, oh my gosh, he sees it. I am unwilling to accept it, and I'm done.
Yes.
It ended. I mean, then I was in grief, and so what happens after that is that I'm just, you know, many of us have a defense mechanism, and when that defense mechanism is broken, I mean, it keeps us alive, it keeps us going, it keeps us sustained up to a point. But what he had done is he poked the defense mechanism.
Right through it.
Denial, really, like, well, she really is like this, you know. And so then behind the defense mechanism, of course, was many, many years of grief and anger. And that was okay. I mean, I needed it. My therapist had always warned me. So I was like, okay, I'm going to live. I'm going to deal with this. So it was a horrible moment and a good moment. And my son and I have laughed about it ever since. I said, thank you for waking me up.
Yes, I think you stepped into your empowerment at that moment, yeah, as painful as it was, and also for your children to teach, yep, them that you do not need to hide or be a secret. There is nothing, yes, shameful about you that you need to be in the shadows of your own existence. So I think it was such a powerful moment of change for you to own your own self as a woman in the world and you know, not be under your mother's judgments and criticisms and such that were really about her own unhealed pain that she didn't address.
Yeah.
And that's the second moment in your book that really, a moment that struck me was, you all were in the hospital. I don't remember if it was actually right before her passing, but mm-hmm, your mother, a doctor or nurse, had witnessed her being verbally abusive and thought to give her, like, have a psychiatrist come in for a, like, mental health status exam. Yep. And actually, she was diagnosed with mental illness. And that was an aha moment for you, that your mother, and a theme of the book is mental illness and growing up in a family with mental illness. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, and, you know, people ask me about that, and I say, well, the way I grew up and I spent 50 years, there was no name for what was wrong with these people. They just acted out all the time, and my grandmother, too, and my mother. And so this psychiatrist had agreed to speak to me, and so we literally had to hide from my mother because she didn't want me to talk to him, and she was very controlling, and oh, God, it was terrible. Anyway, he agreed to meet with me, and he was very compassionate. So he was the only professional. I had been a therapist for many years by then, and the only professional that had actually seen my mother live and in person. I mean, my own therapist knew about her through all the stories and knew a lot, you know, but he saw her. He took one look at her. I could see him. I knew what he was doing. And he just said, well, she's hypermanic, is part of bipolar. And I told him about my grandmother and her dark depression. And I said, well, maybe it runs in the family. And he said, yes, it often does. And there was finally this name for this pain and chaos and all these things. And it just helped. It just really helped to have a name for the you know, for what had gone wrong forever. And it helped me in the end. We had, I was with my mother when in the very last days of her life, and she wept and held her arms out to me and welcomed me, whether it was out of her own need or her awareness. I don't know. Finally, she couldn't talk anymore, so she couldn't abuse me.
Right.
made it easier to be there, I'll tell you. And it was all fine. We just cried a lot, you know.
And you were able to forgive her, too. You share that in Song of the Plains. That on her deathbed, you found full forgiveness.
Yeah, I did. I absolutely just felt the understanding of the generation. I knew the generational story. I hadn't published my memoir yet, but I had done all that work, you know. And I saw the sweep of the generations. I saw the layers. I saw what they had learned, my mother and the other women, as they grew up. And they did the best they could. It wasn't just the platitude. I saw that. I felt that. And so that was beautiful.
Yes, very beautiful. So what is next for you, Linda Joy, having put out this memoir? What is important for you in looking ahead?
Well, one of the things is that I'm going to continue teaching memoir, and I love memoir, and I love literature in general. And I'm very interested in history. So I've done some research about World War II, which also I write in the book that my grandmother was quite engaged and interested in World War II because she'd lived through it. And I'm interested in people who make a difference. So I'm doing some research on someone who helped rescue 1,500 refugees from southern France after the fall of France. And these included Chagall and thinkers like Hannah Arendt and artists like Max Ernst and André Bazin.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. A huge amount of amazing people. And I'm absolutely fascinated with good stories about how people save people. I suppose it's part of my theme, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
How do you create redemption? I mean, what are the redemption stories? You know, I think that's, and so for the audience, I mean, you know, we can be looking at whether people want to write memoir or not, or fiction or blogs, you know, but I think it's the world, I believe, needs us to think in terms of how do we forgive? How do we go heal and go forward with a new relationship with ourselves and with others? And what are the stories of people that have saved and made a difference, you know, saved people and made a difference in the world? And how can we use that to help the world now?
I think it's really important, especially in today's time where people are feeling so much confusion and fear with various terrorist attacks going on regularly and not knowing how to handle or cope. So I think, yeah, it's really important to be a voice offering ways to be able to reinvent ourselves every day. I think redemption is the opportunity is with every new morning, with every day and throughout our day, how we're going to create ourselves and recreate ourselves.
Yes, there's this ongoing opportunity. And I think that when we get afraid and when we get stuck, which we all do, it's normal. But how, you know, the question is, how do I find another place to stand with this information? And I think this is what art, the arts of all kinds, does and offers, music, any kind of visual art. In fact, I'm painting again. I had a degree in art too, but I focused on writing a lot. But now I'm going to do both as I write this novel, because it's about art and artists and, you know, how do people have free expression? And we're in a world now that, you know, people need to be reminded and supported about that.
Yes. And I think turning to the arts and creativity in general for our listeners listening, whatever modality it might be. And I have clients come in, I imagine you do as well, feeling and saying, I don't have a creative bone in my body. And that's just simply not true. Anyone listening believing that is not true. We all have gifts and abilities, whatever they are. And even for me, I'm an artist. I'm a glass artist. And I,
Thank you.
I draw stick figures. So when I sketch, it's literally, it looks horrible, but that's not, my brain works in abstraction. So the little stick figures are to get me, I see abstractly. So to anyone listening, you don't have to paint realistically or it's just an expression of emotion is what I think art, music, writing is. So I encourage anyone listening to go take a class or try something. I'm feeling just the need to share that as we're talking.
Oh, I'm with you completely. I mean, you know, and so many of us, and I was like that when I first did art. I had the same voices. No, I can't do art and I'm terrible and I can't draw and this and that. But I took a class. And I went, wow, this is fun. And so you have to give yourself that chance and to be willing to be an apprentice and a learner. And I tell my memoir students, oh, I know this isn't very good, blah, blah, blah. I said, you know, well, you're beginning. And B, you know what good writing is. Like I was saying earlier, you know what good writing is. Therefore, you're kind of critical about yourself, but be an apprentice. Be willing to write, like Anne Lamott says, some shitty first draft, you know, and be willing to learn and take classes and invest in your vision and, you know, and your inner critic will come, but you have to help it shut up and go away and just do your work. And it builds, it really does build over time.
And I like Linda Joy a few moments ago when you said when you took your first painting class and it was fun. And it's like that realization of, oh, my gosh, this is even fun. And to give ourselves permission to be a child again in these ways.
Play.
Like to play. It's so important to play. It's not about is this good enough to play Carnegie Hall, as your grandmother said. It's am I enjoying this experience? And maybe in your enjoyment, you will play Carnegie Hall. But the drive and motivation is through fun.
Yes, so important. And that's why I quit playing for a while. It wasn't fun. And I went, okay, I give myself the gift and the permission to do what is fun now. And if I want to play music again later, I will. But right now, I want to paint. I want to draw. I want to write. And, you know, so I did that. And then I played again many years later. And so we just have to let that inner voice of permission continue to be alive and to feed it and water it like you would a plant.
Yes. You know, and I think, too, Linda Joy, that as adults, we often don't like to try something that we're not already good at. We somehow pick up specialization and development that we can only do things we're good at. And I think when you really start to stretch your boundaries and grow, or where you do new things that you suck at first, and just to keep with it and for more enjoyment and personal expansion and growth, that we don't have to just do the things we're good at. Because I think those things become kind of boring eventually.
Yeah, and the idea of adventuresomeness and in this, I think there's a humbleness in being a learner.
And yes.
I think we're in a world also where everything is production, production, production. And I teach my students, I say, you know, I want you to do some writing that is non-productive oriented. Write a poem or write in your journal or write a story by hand in your journal. And don't worry or think about whether will it go in your book, you know, relax. Let your mind have a few minutes to itself.
Yes.
You know? Let your creative self, it'll go in a direction you didn't even expect, but you have to give it some room. You have to give it a pause and some time. And in our busy lives, sometimes that's a challenge.
And I'm appreciating that piece of feedback, being a first-time author, thinking I'd finish my book in a year, and I'm approaching that year mark, and I'm rewriting it for a third time because, again, thank you. This is a brand-new experience, and I haven't been good at it, in air quotes. Of course, how would I if I've never done this? But each time I go through rewriting it, more ideas come and more creativity. So I've just surrendered to the process. The book will write itself and be done when it's done. I don't know how much longer it will take. So it helps what you just said.
Excellent.
Thank you.
The process is the process, you know, and I did learn a lot about this from music, because when you're learning to play the piano, you have to practice, and you're not good at first. And if you stop there, you would never get any better. And so actually learning music was a very big help in learning art and in learning, you know, it's different than, I mean, all learning has an arc and all that. But I think in the arts, we just need to be kinder to ourselves and give ourselves more permission, because the world doesn't always do that.
Yes. And on that note, I'd like to share with listeners how they can find you, purchase your book. Your website is LindaJoyMyersAuthor.com and M-Y-E-R-S, like Myers Lemons. And is that your preferred way of people reaching out? And your books are available on Amazon. Can you just say
they're
a little bit about
available everywhere. They can be ordered in any bookstore. Don't Call Me Mother and Song of the Plains are my memoirs. And then I have a book on memoir writing called The Power of Memoir. And I've co-authored some other books on, co-edited some books on skill. But one inspiring book I love to mention is The Magic of Memoir. My colleague, Brooke Warner, whom I teach a class with, we decided that we were talking about how magic memoir is, and we decided to name our book that, and invite people to write about how memoir is magic for them. And we've got some famous authors in there, including an interview with Mary Carr and some other, Danny Shapiro, other well-known people, and also regular people like you and me that just find something amazing about it. So we love that book.
Wonderful. Linda Joy, thank you for being with us today. I really appreciate you taking your time out.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Lisa. It was a pleasure talking with
You're welcome. It was. Right. And I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That concludes our show for today. Please listen in next week as I bring you another guest. I hope everyone has a great week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to All Things Therapy with Lisa Tahir only.